You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
10 koutou katoa. Ko Jessica Toku Ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. E whai aki nei coming up on the show for our regular catch-up. I speak to ACT MP Simon Court about the latest One News Varian poll, and I report on the government announcing a review into disability support services and new measures to address challenges faced by those with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, FASD, and their whānau. I speak to Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Care Action Network, FASDCAN Chairperson Lee Henderson, Clinical Neuropsychologist and Clinical Director of the FASD Centre Aotearoa, Dr. Valerie McGinn, leader of Kickback Make Change, a non-profit organisation serving rangatahi experiencing homelessness, and Byron, a young person with FASD. He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka oa e wariwari e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kororo ano he pakihiri, roki roki mā runga i ti pai tuku tuku o irarangi poho. Mi haere ki 95BFM era kati.com, and you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on our website 95BFM.com under Becasts.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Last week, One News released its latest Varian political poll, which saw the ACT Party go down 1 point to 7% from its latest poll, and New Zealand First go down 2 points to 4%, below the 5% threshold needed to get into Parliament. On these numbers, Labour, the Greens and Te Pāti Māori would have enough seats to form a coalition government. For our weekly catch-up, I spoke to ACT MP Simon Court about the poll's findings, as well as how popular the government's public sector job cuts and fast-track approvals bill has been, according to the poll. Here is that interview. First of all, we saw that the latest One News Varian poll had a majority of people saying they agreed with the government's public service job cuts. 34% agreed with the cuts and 18% said that the government should go further. How far does the government plan to go with these cuts?
Well, I think it is important to recognise that the public do support some restructuring and actually pulling back the size and scope of government. We're going to continue to look into what should government be doing across a number of areas. Some of that detail will come out in the budget, but I think it's also important to note there are some parts of public sector spending where we need to continue to invest, and potentially at much higher levels. In health and education would be obvious areas, but defence as well. The defence budget has been cut, and there's been significant underinvestment in defence accommodation, defence equipment, defence force salaries. And as a result, we've seen a real hollowing out of professions, particularly around engineering, maintenance. We've got a number of naval vessels that are just tied up at the moment. We don't have enough crew for them. The people who would staff them can't afford to live in places like Auckland. So we've got some things we need to continue to invest in while we look for further savings.
So you've spoken then about reprioritising investments, but we've seen that 3,000 people in the public sector have lost their jobs. Can you tell us exactly how many more people we can expect to lose their jobs?
No, I can't, but I'd like BFM listeners to think about this context. Between 2017 and 2023, over 15,000 additional people were employed in the core public service. The numbers went from around about 48,000, 49,000 to something around 63,000 people. And quite a few thousand were employed between July 2023 and the end of 2023. So when we're thinking about public service cuts, potentially some of the departments have identified 2,000 to 3,000 roles may become redundant. That's really only taking the number back to, say, July 2023. I think it's really important to keep that in context because we do have to find savings. The previous government left significant budget items unfunded. And so that's why we do need to reprioritise some of the things that the government's not going to do in the future and the roles that are associated with those functions are therefore not needed.
It's been reported that it could be around 7,000 public sector roles being cut. Is this a number that ACT would support or would you want to see this go further?
Look, my background is in delivering construction projects, and so I know you need the right people in the right roles in order to deliver things. So I don't think it's wise to pick a number. What we need is to right-size the public service and make sure that the functions of government are delivering for New Zealanders. And so if you're sending your children to school or if you're attending university, you want to know that the services that are being provided, the quality of education that's being provided is going to meet the needs of the students and their families. Likewise, when it comes to the health system, if you need elective surgery, what we know is that we actually need nurses and doctors to be there to deliver the services. And when it comes to defence, we've got to play our part. So I think making sure we've got the right people in the right roles, that they're being paid and compensated adequately for what they're doing in the public sector is really, really important because for a lot of people who work in the public sector and the public service, they're doing it because they want to deliver a good service and we need to resource them to do that.
Speaking of infrastructure, only 40% of those polled said they supported the government's fast-track approvals bill. Why do you think this is?
Well, I think New Zealanders are really, really concerned that in the past few years, very few major projects have got off the ground, and the ones that have proceeded essentially have been because of an emergency. And if you think about them, the project to replace the Manawatu Gorge Highway, that only went ahead after multiple slips closed that main road that links the western part of the lower North Island to the eastern part. New Zealanders are genuinely concerned about their environment. I think when it comes to the fast track, though, a lot of the concern around the environment and around potential environmental effects could well be misplaced, because while ministers will have the ability to refer a project into the system for consenting, the consent conditions that are going to come out with major project decisions are likely to be very similar to what we see now. And I think that points to the need for a fast track, but also the need for wider resource management reform. If we're going to be consenting major projects like ports, like highways, like wastewater treatment plant upgrades, and they're pretty much going to have the same consent conditions as the last one and the one before that, then it seems as an opportunity to actually refine the consenting process and codify a lot of these consent conditions so we do away with this churn and with this repetition. I think fast track's going to cut through some of that, but the ultimate goal has to be replacing the resource management system, which one that is permissive to infrastructure, where we know what the environmental effects are and the best way to manage them, and we actually let the designers, the constructors and the operators of this infrastructure just get on with it rather than having to force them to go through a consenting process that's so onerous and repetitive each time.
Like you mentioned, many people are concerned about the environmental impact of this bill. Would ACT consider supporting limiting the amount of consents for projects that would cause environmental harm, like new seabed mining, aquaculture, irrigation dams, or mining on conservation land in particular?
Well, I think it's really important to judge each project on its merits. And yeah, the projects you've described there, from mining the seabed for minerals through to irrigation or mining on the surface, each one has its own environmental benefits that come along with some environmental costs. When you think about building dams, for example, in Northland, three dams are part of a program to increase water storage in the north. I was talking to one of the project developers for a dam near Kaikoi last week, and he said that the water that will be stored there is going to unlock a whole lot of land for kiwi fruit growing and fruit growing, similar to what they do in Kerikeri or in the Bay of Plenty. It's going to provide hundreds and hundreds of continuous jobs and a huge economic boost to the region. So I think it's important that when we consider taking water that would otherwise flow to the sea and storing it in a reservoir so it can be used to grow food and therefore employ people and create social and economic opportunities, we have to weigh that against the potential short-term effects of construction and trucks and dust and noise. Now, I think you could apply the same thing to even large-scale mining on public land, remembering that the conservation estate only includes a few national parks. The vast bulk of the land managed by DOC is actually farmland, commercial forestry, or land that doesn't have high conservation values. And if you think about mining as something where you do have to clear some vegetation, you have to do some earthworks, you get the minerals out, and then you put everything back in a way that if you or I were to walk through that area a decade or two afterwards, we could look around and we wouldn't necessarily know there'd ever been a mine there. That's the standard of environmental protection and restoration we should be aspiring to, while making sure during the construction and development phase that any offsite effects, such as sediment discharge, for example, are well within acceptable limits. I think we can do this in New Zealand. We do it now. We can do more of it. It's just the fast-track process is needed because the Resource Management Act has failed us. We can't actually go out there and apply for projects confident that if we know how to manage environmental effects well, we'll still get the consent at the end of the process. At the moment, it's up in the air because our system has failed us over many years.
Would ACT be open to discussing changing those three ministers having final oversight over projects, particularly, as you said, if there are benefits to certain projects? If there are concerns as well, such as the harm, the permanent harm that mining on something like conservation land could cause, would you be open to supporting having these three ministers not having final oversight?
Well, Jess, I have the really interesting role of sitting on the Environment Committee that's hearing the Fast Track Bill. And so, we've heard already submissions from Federated Farmers, Forest and Bird, Greenpeace, New Zealand Planning Institute, all of whom have suggested improvements to the bill. And so as the bill goes through the Select Committee hearings process, I mean, there's thousands of people who've submitted, hundreds of organisations have asked to be heard. I'm sure we'll identify ways to improve the bill when the Environment Committee reports it back to the House. And at that point, it will be up to the to Cabinet to decide whether to accept those changes or not. I think we'll find improvements.
We might have to wrap up pretty soon, so we'll save that next topic for next time. But I just finally want to acknowledge the poll's other result, which was that New Zealand First would be out of government and Labour, Greens and Te Pāti Māori would have a combined majority. Do you think the public has an appetite for ACT's policies that it contributed to coalition negotiations based on this result?
Certainly do. I mean, it is one poll, the One News Varian poll, which had ACT at around 7%. We got about 8.6% at the election. But last week also we had a Roy Morgan poll which showed ACT at 11%. But 2.5 years out from the next election, it's important to take all of these things with a grain of salt. I think it's very clear that New Zealanders are feeling very nervous, fragile about their personal circumstances, their personal finances. All of this arises from the performance of the last government. Labor's borrowing, taxing and spending. People voted for change, but that change still seems quite a long way off. We're going through a period of high inflation. that's persistent, high interest rates, people's mortgage costs and rent costs are all inflated because of that. So we understand that people are hurting, and that's why we think it's really, really important we continue with the reform program, cut government waste and spending, make it easier to build. You know, we want to unlock affordable housing. If we can show progress in the next couple of years before the next election, I'm sure Kiwis will give us their vote again and show us that confidence.
How about New Zealand First and Winston Peters then? Do you think that the public's support for him has wavered?
Well, you know, that's what the poll indicated. But, you know, what I'm focused on as an ACT Member of Parliament, you know, a construction manager who has the privilege of representing people and trying to affect change, is focusing on the things that Kiwis need me to do and ACT to do. And we'll leave New Zealand First and the other parties to work out what they need to do.
That was ACT MP Simon Court on the results of the latest One News Varian poll.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Talking about feelings is hard,
but we've got good news.
Buy Now have all the records you need to communicate your mood.
Feeling sad in a sexy way?
They've got Lana Del Rey.
Angry in a feminist way?
They've got Bikini Kill.
Anxious in a fun way?
They've got Hans Puckett.
Never talk about your feelings ever again.
Buy Out, your local record store off Karangahape Road at 80 Fitz Street. Open from 10 a.m. every day, stocking all the good stuff with frequent in-stores and always open online. Free shipping throughout Aotearoa.
R.I.P. Mittens. She's gone. At least I have these photos to remember her. Look, her first steps.
Aww.
Eating her first bird.
Ew.
And her last moment. I call this one raspberry jelly.
Ugh, why? What?
Damn that car.
What is that shining in the gutter?
Her beautiful angelic eye.
Pro Gear Photographic. For photos that'll bring out the light in your eyes, no matter the circumstance. Head to Pro Gear for all your photography needs. Open now at 3 Railway Street, Newmarket, or go to progear.co.nz.
Oh, hey, hey.
Yeah, I haven't seen you around for ages. What have you been up to?
Yeah, just been real bogged down thinking about space.
Oh, like planets and black holes and stuff?
Yeah, quasars, asteroids, really all the space stuff.
Oh, yeah, so that's your new job now? Like at the observatory?
Nah, just been thinking about it. It's taken me ages, though. It's big ass.
Okay.
Spaced Out.
Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday, only on 95BFM Drive.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
You know, our call is fuck normal. Sorry, I swore. It's important.
That's okay. It's BFM.
The Wire.
You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395.
You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, FASD, is a neural disability caused by prenatal alcohol exposure, which can affect memory, intellectual ability, and emotional regulation. The Ministry of Health estimates that between 3 to 5% of the population in Aotearoa are affected by FASD, with around 1,800 to 3,000 babies being born with FASD each year. The government has recently announced it will be establishing new guidelines to help health professionals diagnose FASD, introducing a program to support families, and launching a FASD prevention campaign. First, I spoke to Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Care Action Network, FASDCAN, Chairperson Lee Henderson. FASDCAN is a non-profit incorporated society made up of parents, caregivers, extended whānau and professionals. I spoke to Henderson about how the government can better support those with FASD And we started off our interview discussing what difference Henderson believes the government's proposed initiatives will make. Here is that interview.
It's important to have improved diagnostic capacity. It means that you can understand the person as to whether their behaviour is due to that brain impairment. It stops that blame culture about poor parenting, but also provides some understanding when you interact with professionals, whether it may be justice or education or mental health or other areas, that they can understand that that person is suffering, has a disability, and that's why they are as they are. So diagnosis is really important. Obviously, prevention is very important as well. We have a high level of unplanned pregnancies in New Zealand, and we would like to significantly reduce the number of those that are alcohol exposed. But perhaps the most important part of the announcement is the reactivation of the action plan, which was set up and started 8 years ago now. It was a three-year action plan. It identified areas that needed to change in New Zealand to support those with FASD. And while some of the work has been done, it hasn't been well funded. It hasn't really been coordinated across the agencies because FASD impacts so many agencies: health, mental health, disability, education, corrections, youth. And it really requires a concerted effort to try to change the impacts and effects on the individuals and society of this disorder. So we're hopeful that the commitment from Dr. Reti and his ministry to take this seriously will make some progress. Progress has been extremely slow and disappointing in some aspects.
What issues do you perceive there being with the current clinical diagnostic process of children with FASD?
It's been very hard to access. Some of our families report having tried to get diagnosis since their child was two, not getting until they were 9 years old. Some, in fact, don't get them until teenage years. There's a lot of advocacy that goes on, and resources are restricted because there's only a few clinics, and many of those have been somewhat committed to looking at children that are entering care, because 50% of children entering care are thought to have FASD, or those that are entering the justice system, and occasionally because of behavioural concerns through the education system. But otherwise, families are having to resort, if they are very well off, to pay for private diagnosis, up to $9,000 a time. So access to more diagnostic capacity is really important.
Then why is diagnosis so important? And when is the best time in a child's life to be able to be diagnosed? Does it make a difference if it's earlier on?
Early intervention is critical. The earlier that you know you've got a person with FASD, the more likely you are to provide supports to them around education in particular. And some of that protection work, the children can be very vulnerable. So, you know, you may alter your parenting to accommodate them, not to use, you know, things like tough love because they do not understand consequences, but using a completely different parenting style that takes account of their brain-based disability. But, of course, this is a very variable disorder, and for some it may be obvious even from birth occasionally. Occasionally there's the facial features that are associated with FASD for over 90%. It will be other things that start to drive a concern, and unfortunately for some, that may not happen until teenage years or even adulthood. And those are stages where you're less likely to be able to mitigate the risk of the adverse effects because you haven't had early intervention. So the sooner the better.
In terms of a national action campaign, what would you like to see that focus on in particular?
Well, the first thing that we think is essential is to provide disability support for people with FASD, just as you can get for physical disabilities and some neurodisabilities. That would allow people to be able to have teacher aides, it would be able them to have respite care, it would be able to put in place all of the structure around those children to stop some of those secondary effects of mental health effects and school exclusion and so on. So disability support is the main one, but the second part of it is professional training. And over the past few years, there's been an increase in awareness of FASD, but that does not equate to understanding. And this syndrome, this spectrum disorder affects right across so many different portfolios, but police, justice, appearing before courts, understanding that brain is critical to actually providing the best environment for that person. And so professional training is critical at the moment. We are providing some of that training. We've provided training to judges. We've provided training to education professionals. We've provided training to social workers, care workers, and so on. But it needs to be a coordinated and funded approach. And at the moment, what we are doing is done mainly without any government funding. We're using charity. We're using philanthropic sources to actually do that. And it's very difficult to be able to reach the professionals that need to be reached.
Was there anything that wasn't included in the government's announcement that you would like to see when it comes to supporting people and families with FASD and raising awareness?
That's a very good question, because really there is no detail in that announcement. They've said that they will review the progress and identify gaps in the progress. So what we don't know is what that will mean, but particularly what it will mean in terms of an organisation such as ours, in terms of the need for funding, just as you get funding for Autism New Zealand and other organisations, to actually be able to ensure that we can continue to support families who are living with people with this disorder. Yesterday there was an announcement from the new Minister for Disability on a review of disability support. We welcome that, because we're hopeful that that will mean an increase in funding, because we think it's essential to increase funding both at the family level and at the Paikaha Ministry for Disabled People. But we have one reservation about that, and that is that for many years now, there has been advocacy to uphold the rights of people with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder in New Zealand. It's been the rights have been upheld by the United Nations in their review of New Zealand's compliance with the Convention on the Rights of Disabled People. And the announcement yesterday said they would address eligibility for services. It feels to me that could constitute treading water, that we were hopeful that the work that PICAR has already started on eligibility would mean that sometime before too long we would get some outcome from that. And it just feels like this could be a step that will stall that progression. And our families are in distress. They need support, and further investigation and perhaps going back to square one will not help those families.
I also spoke to clinical neuropsychologist and clinical director of the FASD Centre Aotearoa, Dr. Valerie McGinn. The FASD Centre Aotearoa assesses and helps with the management of children, young people and adults with FASD. I started off our interview by asking Dr. McGinn for her thoughts on the government's announcement.
They have said that they'll train 30 diagnosticians within the District Health Board, I presume within the Child Development Centres, to recognise and diagnose FASD, which will be a very good thing, because currently many children with FASD, or most children, are sort of slipping through the cracks, and they really only come to our attention when things have gone horribly wrong. So it would be very good if we could get diagnosis at a younger age and services in place. I guess the problem is that the Ministry of Health specifically exclude people with FASD from disability support services. So that's still a problem that remains and hasn't been rectified. And so one thing is to get a diagnosis and understand what's going on, and that will help families know how to manage a child who may have difficulties, but it doesn't really provide extra support for them as they should be entitled to with a disability. There's no other disability specifically excluded from disability support services, and as far as I know, New Zealand's the only country in the world that specifically discriminate against people with FASD in that way.
Yeah, so speaking of that, the government has announced a review into disability support services. Do you have any concerns about this, or what would you like to see from this review?
Well, I think that, you know, this has been a long-term problem. It's not as if it's one government that's failed to address this. Multiple governments have failed to address it. So I guess I would like FASD at least to be on the same footing, say, as ASD and other, that's autism spectrum disorder and other disabilities. But in saying that, you know, all the disabilities are very lightly funded. And but with FASD in particular, the cost to the individual and society is huge, because we know that when there aren't services in place, these young people go on into the criminal justice system, and that's because they, it's not because they're bad people, because they're not at all, it's because they behave inappropriately, and that's not recognised as a symptom of their disability, so they get caught up in the criminal justice system, and that puts them on a kind of escalator towards, you know, multiple problems that are actually very expensive to rectify if you leave it until later in life. So a lot of cost savings could be made by putting resources in at an earlier age.
Is there anything else that you would like to see from the government to support those with FASD, or to support organisations that support those with FASD?
Well, I think currently FASD CAN, which is FASD Care Action Network, which is our agency charity that is there to be set up to support families and individuals with FASD. I was a founding member of that organisation, you know, has not been funded in the same way as other organisations that support other disabilities. And so, you know, there's so much that can be done, but there's really no funding to do it beyond a group of very dedicated and expert parents and caregivers. So, you know, that certainly needs bolstering up. And, you know, all of our social services need training and health services to understand what FASD is, so that can be recognised at a young age and can be accommodated. And I guess, you know, we do know what works and what to do, but we've just never really been given the funding to this particular disability. And I think there's more people with FASD than any other disability. So, you know, a prevention campaign we've had in the past, and that's all good, but we're not ever, and drinking has reduced significantly. I think our young people coming through are much more sensible about, you know, not drinking to excess, but nevertheless we also have a generation of young adults and adults who need support right now because they face multiple adversities. So of course we also want, you know, it to be known in the wider public that drinking in pregnancy has, you know, serious risks associated with it.
Yeah, so specifically from a prevention campaign, what would you like to see in that?
You know, if we look to Canada, which is where we always look to because they're so advanced compared to New Zealand, it's not just that there's a campaign around, you know, don't drink. There needs to be much wider recognition that alcohol harm in New Zealand and drinking is a problem that crosses all sectors of society, and it's not fair or even sensible to attribute this to women who drink, because they drink alongside men and alongside aunties and nans. So, you know, drinking is a widespread problem in New Zealand. So we need to, I think, look at our whole alcohol culture and protect the mums and protect the babies so that they can go on to, you know, have a full life without a disability. So in Canada, everyone knows what FASD is, but in New Zealand, there's a whole health service that don't know what FASD is, and our parents, who've become expert through having to learn what to do, are ending up going into their GP or even, you know, to see a psychiatrist or to see mental health workers, and they're having to inform them about what FASD is because the health workforce is not considered as important, you know, just due to lack of training and ignorance, and maybe also in some cases the health professionals' own drinking habits, which also enter into the equation. You know, one thing that I hope comes out of this, you know, drinking is not an Indigenous problem. It's not a problem particular to Maori. But, you know, Maori do have really good models of health and wellness that, you know, really can be very effectively applied to caring for and looking after individuals with FASD. So I think, you know, bolstering that aspect of the workforce, handing resources over to iwi to address these problems. I'm not saying it's only their problem, because it's not. I mean, the largest group of drinkers are actually in pregnancy, a professional woman. But there is, you know, binge drinking and all sorts of issues with colonisation. So I think, you know, resources are needed across the board, but particularly to our Maori organisations who do have the right models to know how to work with this issue.
To hear from a person with FASD, I spoke to Byron, a young adult, about his experience with FASD and what support he would like to see from the government. Can you just tell our listeners what your experience was like being diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder?
My experience is a bit of a mixed experience, to be honest. I wasn't too keen to learn much about it until a couple of years back. For quite a while, I was aware that I had it and sort of understood how it played a part in my life, you know, in different situations. I wasn't really that keen to acknowledge it and address it.
Yeah, if you feel comfortable, could you talk a little bit about why you might not have felt comfortable to get that diagnosis?
Yeah, I think the reason for that was I didn't want to put a label on it. I didn't want to think of myself as disabled or different or some, or, you know, any kind of stigma about it. But up until a couple of years ago, when I connected with FASCAN and met other individuals with FASD, I'm actually, I accept it as you know, it's part of me, it's who I am, and it doesn't define me.
And since receiving your diagnosis, what has your experience been like?
I'd have to say, yeah, it's a pretty mixed experience in terms of when I announce it to clinicians or GPs or other healthcare professionals. Usually they aren't very educated about FASD. I usually have to give them a quick, you know, crash course on what FASD is, and just guide them to the FASCAN New Zealand website to get more information.
So the government has announced that we'll be establishing new guidelines to help health professionals better recognise and diagnose FASD. What do you think about this, and what would you like to see included in those guidelines?
Yeah, I think they've still got a long way to go, as most of the healthcare sector isn't aware of FASD or its effects. That includes the justice sector as well, police and the courts. They're still really undereducated on FASD and how that affects the individuals who have it. I think it's really great that they've made this announcement, but FASCAN New Zealand has already been training professionals and different types of professionals for quite a while now.
Yeah, and getting that diagnosis, have you found that that's made it easier for you in any way to go about life and do the things that you want to do?
I think it's helpful. It's helpful to know, to remember when I'm struggling with something, that actually, you know, I don't need to be too hard on myself, and my brain does work differently than other people, but it doesn't set any limitations on what I can achieve. You know, in fact, it can be the opposite. If you're motivated enough, having FSD can not even be a barrier to trying to achieve your goals. It can actually help, because you're really motivated to overcome your barriers and your challenges.
Is there anything that you would like to see from the government to support those with FASD or organisations that support those with FASD?
Yeah, I think it's critical that the government recognises FASD as a full disability with ACC. So it's recognised as a full disability with ACC and by the government. At the moment, it's incredibly hard to access even a disability allowance, let alone a disability benefit for FASD. I know from personal experience, I've had to go through great lengths just to try and get some of that assistance from them.
Is there anything that you want people to know about FASD, or maybe a misconception about FASD that people have?
Probably just that we're all human beings, just like everyone else. Our brains just work slightly differently, and if people took the time to learn a little bit about FASD, they would know that all these individuals need is just that little bit of extra support, compassion and understanding. They're making it nearly impossible to access this any assistance at the moment for people with FASD. I was lucky enough to have support from a mentor, like an advocate mentor service, and my parents. But I think of individuals who are living on their own, they would find it impossible to jump through the hoops that MSD is asking people to do in order to get this disability allowance or any sort of assistance.
The government has also announced a review into disability support services.
I spoke to leader of Kickback Make Change, Aaron Hendry,
a non-profit organisation serving rangatahi experiencing homelessness, about support needed for young people who have disabilities, including FASD, who are facing homelessness. Here is that interview.
It's really important that the review is done and that we have a really look at where the gaps are for, you know, specifically, you know, for our young people, and that the resources and the support is put into ensuring that we are able to best serve our community well.
What challenges do you see people with disabilities facing that the government could do more to address?
Yeah, like one of the big intersections we see and a real concern that many of us in the sector have is our young people with FASD. You know, right now, if you've got FASD and you're a young person, there's a real lack of services and supports available for you, and a lack of recognition within, I guess, you know, disability services to really respond to that and to provide the support for that. And so we see a lot of young people that, you know, have FASD who are sleeping rough, who don't have the support they need. You know, when we look at the services that we have available for young people experiencing homelessness, there's already a lot of gaps. And then when we look at the support we need to really care well for young people who have FASD, we just don't have the services that exist to do, you know, the long-term journey that those young people need into adulthood, to provide them with the support to ensure that they're going to be cared for and supported and healthy and well.
The government has also announced some new measures that they're going to introduce to support those with FASD, including some diagnostic guidelines for health professionals to be able to better diagnose FASD, a prevention campaign and a support kind of group for people with FASD and their families. What do you make of these measures, and what further support would you like to see from the government to support those with FASD?
Yeah, I mean, even more ease of access to the diagnosis is great. You know, ensuring that we have much better education in the community is also really important. So, you know, those are good things. One of my real concerns is how we are going to care for young people that heavy FASD and are for whatever reason not able to live at home, how do we provide them with the support and service they need? So, you know, right now, you know, we have a lot of conversation around young people and, you know, crime and justice and all of that. And we know that, you know, some of our young people that are going in through the justice system, heavy FASD, some of the driving factors to them kind of being involved and causing harm in the community was, you know, alongside the disability, trauma, lack of safe or stable places to live, funneled into the justice system. They come out again, you know, again, they're still without a secure space to stay. They don't have the community or support around them, and they're straight back into the justice system. And so, you know, we've got to disrupt that pipeline, and it really looks like ensuring we have long-term sustainable care packages for these young people. So, one, they're not going through that experience of having to sleep on our streets as children with a disability. They have, you know, actual housing services that can be equipped to support them, but also long-term, that there is a sustainable support package for those children who are going to grow up into young people who grow up into adults, and ensuring that they get the support they need over a lifetime to be adequately cared for. One of my fears, really, young people that I have known, loved and cared for in various services is knowing that maybe we've been able to put something around them for, you know, a couple of years, but, you know, they're going to grow up and we don't have the supports in place long term to ensure that they are going to live healthy, thriving lives. And so I think we really need to take seriously the challenge we're facing there and ensure there is adequate investment into ensuring that these children get the support that they need.
What are your thoughts on the government's approach so far to young people who may be causing harm?
Yeah, and I want to be clear, it's not just this government. I think, you know, within our, for a long time, we have found it far easier to focus on sort of very simplistic, tough-on-crime narratives while ignoring what we know is actually happening in our communities. And one of the things that is actually happening is that we have children with disabilities, such as FASD and others, children with extreme severe trauma, children living without stable accommodation, experiencing homelessness, who are then, because of all of those factors, getting involved in, you know, harmful behaviour in our communities, being funneled into the justice system, being chucked back out on the other side. And so I think we have to start taking these things seriously. If we want to change what's going on in our communities, then we need to deal with reality. We need to deal with what's really happening. And so right now, we're kind of talking about criminalising children who have a disability and punishing young people who, and in some cases, don't have the brain development to be making healthy, safe choices when they're in situations which are really, you know, extreme and unsafe, situations that you and I wouldn't want to be in, and might make similar decisions if we were. And so I think we need to deal with that. We need to acknowledge that, and we need to have a response that is adequate to the challenge.
Many of these children who will be affected are in state care, and the government is also looking into the oversight of Oranga Tamariki. What would you like to see from this?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, is that, you know, if you're a child and you are in state care, basically and effectively, the government is your parent, you know, you're a ward of the state, and so your state parent has responsibility for you. And, you know, currently and historically, our state parent hasn't done all that it could do to ensure the safety of its children. Instead, we focus very much on punishing these children when, you know, when they make poor decisions and cause harm after we've already made some very poor decisions and caused harm to them. And so we need to take that responsibility really seriously. Our government represents us, and so that means that we have parental responsibility over these children. And we need to start thinking, what would I expect for my own kids? What would I want for my own kids? What resources do I want? And I think every one of us would think we want our children to have the support they need to live well. We want them to live in safe, stable homes. We want them to have supportive and caring and loving people around them, and to be able to get health care and support and food and, you know, all those basic things that we want for our own kids, we need to start thinking about for these children, because it's exactly the same thing. In terms of the oversight bill, look, I applaud the government on sort of listening to the sector and having another look at that. There were some real concerns around the monitoring system being in a government department, and it's good to hear that it's going to be sort of pulled out of that and made an independent Crown agency. That real independence is really vital. It's really important, and we've heard that really clearly from the care experience community. So So I think that's really good, and hopefully, you know, I think the other side of that, we need to make sure that the monitoring system continues to get really well resourced so that we can be ensuring that our young people's voices are both heard and listened to. And especially when we're thinking about young people that have disabilities that are in the care system, you know, there's a lot of work there to understand that experience and to ensure that we are, you know, monitoring what's happening there really well. Like, I think ultimately whenever we have conversations around young people at the moment, you know, we use these terms like young offenders or, you know, criminals and all of that, and it just obscures the reality. And the reality here in Aotearoa is that we have a group of children that have grown up with some really, really terrible living situations, you know, have experienced some really extreme trauma and are going through some really hard stuff. And, you know, some of these young people have disabilities, and some of these young people are living without the sort of support that we would want for ourselves, let alone for our own children. And I think we need to think about that a bit more as we look to evaluate the systems and services and structures that we are designing to care for them, to ensure that actually we are providing what these children need to thrive.
That was Fazd Khan, Chairperson Lee Henderson, Clinical Neuropsychologist and Clinical Director of the FASD Centre Aotearoa, Dr. Valerie McGinn, Leader of Kickback Make Change,
Aaron Hendry,
and Byron, a young person with FASD, on the government's disability policies.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa, mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa, I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That is a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Ni rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.